Cartier-Bresson's work, which is a significant person for us. Cartier-Bresson was the first person to use 35 millimeter as fine art, as a fine art image making device. So we talk about him a little later on, and it's like us showing, like, that's a really blue chip photographer to be showing prints from. That's a really expensive photographer. In other words, if you try to buy prints of original prints from Cartier-Bresson, they're way up there. They're around anywhere from starting prices probably $7,000 to about $15,000 to $25,000 per print. And that's an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper. So that's an expensive image, right? So for them to show his work is kind of showing blue chip. So you can kind of see where Leica, where they're, what market they're shooting for in doing that. But I mean, you know, go and look at the work. That's the key, is don't be intimidated by them and all the boutique BS. Just go in and check out the work, because the imagery is interesting and Cartier-Bresson's work is really good. And this is one of his images on the cover. Hello. What's your name?
Tevin.
I don't want to miss anybody because I missed taking the roll last time, which I always forget, by the way. You might want to remind me. Somebody might want to be in charge of reminding me to take roll. I forget that. This one will, it'll open tonight. No, they're going to do an opening tomorrow night. No, they're going to do an opening next week. That would be cool to hit, actually. That'd be a good opening to see. The wine's probably still cheap, but it's probably free. So you could hit that opening from 6 to 8 in the city. It'd be a good cheap date. It's free to get in. And you can RSVP right there. It'd be a cool show. If I can get down there, I'll probably go see it. Because I have never walked into this gallery. I didn't even know we had a gallery in town. So that's down the list here on the blog a little bit. Another one I'll just talk about real quick, mostly monochrome, is not rhizome. It's marked as rhizome. I'll edit that later. This is actually the Petaluma Art Center, which is right down in Petaluma, just off downtown, down by the railroad station. It is actually the railroad station. The old railroad station converted into an art center. And this exhibition was curated by the other guy that teaches digital photography at the Petaluma campus, Joe McDonald. So there should be quite a bit of photography in this. And that'd be worth seeing if you're down in Petaluma over the weekend or at any point, or if you're from there. And I accidentally tagged it as a rhizome thing. Rhizome I'll tell you about later. I'm blowing all kinds of stuff today. It's actually across the street from the Art Center, the Ice House Gallery, which is Joe's gallery space. So there's the Petaluma Art Center that is on one side of the street next to the railroad tracks. And then right behind it, you'll see a big, long brick building. That's the where the Ice House is. And that's kind of a cool site because inside are galleries and print shops, and there's artist workspaces in that building. So it's kind of cool to go in and see that building, and that's where the Ice House Gallery is. If you map it, you'll see what I mean. So I'll edit that one. Let's see, others. Reiko. So I've got two postings here for you on Reiko. One is an exhibition that's coming up. You'll see there's two or three different exhibitions that it's featuring. So this one that's going to open on tomorrow or tonight. What is the tonight? Their opening reception is next week too, and it's the day before. This one, Reiko Photo, is a place to know. I don't know how much longer they're going to exist, sadly, and it's a really cool place. If you could get to the city, you know, before they close, which they'll probably close, they may close in March. I mean, shut the doors entirely. It's been quite an incredible place. It's emerged as it's analog digital, or it's film and digital lab facility in downtown San Francisco that was started about eight, maybe 10 years now ago. And they allow you to go in, it's like a rental lab space that you can go in and you can check out a computer for the afternoon, and you can send digital images to the darkroom, to the systems in the darkroom, and you can actually print in analog from a digital negative to a print and process it in the space. You can go in there with film and process any kind of film, color or black and white film, and print that way. You can do everything. So you can basically, it was a lab facility that was available to digital and film-based photographers, everything. Plus it had a gallery, plus it did publications. So really amazing photo center. It's patterned after another site that I'll tell you about later called Visual Studies. Visual Studies Workshop in Rochester. And sadly, I got an email from the guy that he's gonna be shutting it down. They're not turning the profit, is the problem. So things have gotten really rough in the city. The cost of everything is way high because of all the tech money that's poured in and all the facilities, all the prices have gone up on rentals, commercial real estate's like out of control. And it's really starting to affect pretty much everything within the arts. And there's probably a residual coming into that too, because photographers probably can't afford to live in the city, so they're living outside the city, and then they're not using the lab facilities as much. And so it's starting to drop. If you can get down here before it closes and see this facility, it's pretty unusual and worth seeing. They also have, in the front, they have a gallery space, and then they have a whole collection of local photographers' works that they actually sell, prints. And you can buy really nice photographs from photographers for very little, for like $50 to $200 a print out of the front. And they do exhibitions, and they do workshops, which you'll see some of the workshops are here. You can see this is one photographer's work, and then this other one is the 10th International Jurid Plastic Camera Show, which is, if you don't know about plastic cameras, going back to the 70s, there were a couple manufacturers in Japan doing plastic cameras with plastic lenses for 2.25 film, which is the wider format film. It's paperback and it's about this wide. And because they had plastic lenses, they had really interesting defects in the images, which led to really cool color effects if you shot color, or really cool vignetting and kind of distortions if you shot in black and white. And plastic cameras became really popular in the 70s as a way to get an interesting kind of, a flawed image out of them, a really kind of interesting image, accidental image. And so it's still going. Plastic cameras have actually made a comeback, and a number of manufacturers are making them more now. They did a juried group show of that, which will be a really cool show to see. So Reiko, I wanted you to know about that site and those exhibitions. Let's see. Then Harvard, you've probably heard of. The De Young has a great show up right now. Danny Lyon, who is a master photographer going back to 50s, throughout the 50s up to the 80s. Really interesting work, documentary, fine art photographer. The De Young, you might have been to that. That's the big tower in the middle of Golden Gate Park. That's the De Young Museum. It's a little pricey to get into. It's definitely, this show would be well worth seeing. This guy's work is pretty exceptional. And on here, there's a couple of films you should maybe see. Pretty interesting guy. I also gave you at the bottom, you'll notice you've got tickets for the lectures. And there's a lecture coming up this Saturday. Family Art Making Curator, Up Close and Personal, the Photograph. So they're gonna do a talk about the show from 2 to 3. Just an hour-long talk. That'd be cool. And the talk is free. Getting into the exhibition would cost you $15 a piece. But it would be a great exhibition to see. That's a museum quality show. That's a big show. You know, that's probably easily 50 to...
I would say it's also $6 for us.
Oh, it's students. Oh yeah, you got a student ID, so you get in cheap. And then the talk is free. So if you happen to be out on Saturday, it's going to rain anyway. That'd be a good show. You might look his work up too. He doesn't show up in your syllabus at any point, Danny Lyons. So I hadn't thought about Danny Lyons for a while. He's one of those documentary photographers from the 60s, kind of follows in Cartier-Bresson's footsteps. I think the photo I always think of with Danny Lyons is he photographed people on motorcycles. I think he was really into motorcycles. And motorcyclists, like Hell's Angels. Okay, so Danny Lyons and the De Young. The De Young is a museum, you'll hear about that. Petaluma Art Center again. There's a call for artwork. Anybody's doing anything other than photo. Or photo, I guess. This is a regional art competition, that'd be fun. I'll give you extra credit if you get in a group show. Let's see, New York Times, the Bits. Anytime you see New York Times Bits, it's probably a posting for my high school class because Bits is the technology feature section for the New York Times, which I post a lot of stuff. The issues in the New York Times Bits is usually pretty interesting and related to image making, especially for digital. So not something you necessarily want to just skim over just because it is that, but it's usually technology related, but not specifically photo related. And then Lens Culture is a magazine or an online, what do they call them? An online portal kind of site, feature site, that's good to know. So be sure and look at Lens Culture too. I gave you one of their photographer's features, which is this guy, Marcus Designo. But be sure and also look at the site. So whenever you go to that site, they're not going to leave you alone anyway. But I did a posting of just that feature, which I wanted you to see. If you scroll down, you'll see a bunch of other features. And if you just knock the end off of it, you can look at Lens Culture itself, which is a pretty interesting. Oh, it's a magazine and a online site for photography, contemporary photography. It's a really cool site. A lot of work, a lot of content, a lot of contemporary photography. Will make you crazy, there's so much content. And in looking at just a couple of these sites, you can see why maintaining a list of contemporary photographers doesn't really make any sense, because there's so much going on in contemporary photography. To keep track of, it's virtually impossible. This is a really good site though, and I know the editors are from Marin, so it usually addresses concerns, you know, that we're interested in, not from some far-flung place dealing with stuff that we're not thinking about. So cool site to check out. Okay, any questions on the blog? Everybody spent a little time with it since Tuesday. Get a sense of it. You can also look back, goes back quite a few years if you scroll down. If it looks like it's too much stuff and you want to kind of reduce the amount of stuff by not much, but you can. If you look over here on the right-hand side where it says categories, media and technology, I tag the ones just for the high school as media and technology. And I tag yours whenever they're specifically just photography and I don't want the high school kids to look at them. I tag those as photography and imaging. It doesn't reduce the load too much though, I gotta tell you, because usually they kind of overlap on both. And so I usually just tag them as one or the other or both. But you can isolate, get rid of some of the stuff that you're not interested in by clicking on those. And everybody was fine with it?
What was the name of the Marin posted website?
Lens Culture. Is that what you mean? The editors are from Marin?
Yeah.
Yeah, Lens Culture. Okay, so syllabus then. Did I get this fixed? Nope, still goes to the end. Syllabus, everybody's fine with this. You got through it. I took out a few things that I didn't think we needed, a couple links that were broken. I didn't really change anything. You won't see any updates probably until Tuesday. I'm sure I'll get in there and mess with it over the weekend, so watch out for that. I'm going to already move up I'll leave that assignment in there, but I probably won't assign shooting and low light to you until Thursday. But, and plus it's gonna rain, so it's gonna be a really crappy weekend to shoot. I don't know, what stage are we in with the moon? Did we look at that? What do you know?
It's not full.
The moon was a week ago?
Yeah.
Was it? So it's on its way down?
Yeah.
Oh, that's too bad, we should have timed it. Should have started a week early. Watch for the moon, because that's a good time to shoot in low light too. But I won't assign, usually the assignments will fall on a week, and what I do is I assign them that week on Thursday. I like to assign them on Thursday. We talk about it Tuesday and Thursday and try to cover as much as we can, kind of backload what you need in order to go out and shoot, and then I give you the weekend to shoot it. And then come in on Tuesday and then we look at them. So, but the low light one, I probably won't give to you. What I'll want you to do over the weekend is come up with some images that we'll look at on Tuesday that show what your interest in photography is. Because I don't think, I didn't expect that from you for today. Okay, good. So let's do that. So, but that's probably right. So. Before we jump into this and start to talk about that, we got that. I'll start sending books around real quick. Anybody want to look at this? This is the textbook. So you won't find that in the bookstore because I didn't get my order placed, and that's completely on me. Although I would have told you as soon as I told you that they were in the bookstore, I would have said, "Don't go there and buy it. You should go somewhere else because it's cheaper." So does Frugal? Does anybody know? Does Frugal still work? Anybody ever use Frugal? If you type in, instead of Google, you type in Frugal, it comes up and you could do price comparisons across multiple sites, and it does a search for you. You might, you know, just look around, like somebody had found that if E. Dalton's cheaper. Is that right? E. Dalton? E. Dalton's cheaper than Amazon?
Barnes and Noble.
Sorry. Yeah?
So it's never going to be in the bookstore?
I'll send them an order if you want over the weekend, and they'll put some in probably in a couple
weeks. Only because I have a voucher to go to the bookstore.
Okay, that's the only reason I've kept up the orders over time. So I'll do that.
Okay.
And you can, I always bring mine, so when we get into chapters and you get a chance, you can grab mine.
Okay.
You can get a lot of different editions. There's a couple of.
You don't have to get that edition?
You don't have to get that edition. You can get any edition that you can open up and inside, and the one with the rowing people on the cover is the one that I think is showing up everywhere. All you want to do is you want to open it up, you want to go back to about a third in the back, and you look to see if it's got the digital stuff, which you open it up and it will say software. It'll say printing and display, editing, and it'll show you things about layers, sharpening. All this is digital. It's pretty easy to identify the digital stuff that's software related. As long as it has that in it, and every edition past 7 has that, you can grab any of those. And check the 4th Street books, because every student has been using this for about 8 years, so there's a lot of them floating around Sonoma County. Anybody else want to see that? Okay, then I'm going to send you around some books that you can just browse while we're talking. One I forgot. I'll bring another one on Tuesday for you. A technical book. This is one technical book I would highly recommend. Even if you're in graphic design and you're going to get a Photoshop book later so that you've got all of Photoshop, this is a book that is Photoshop for Digital Photographers by a guy named Scott Kelby, who runs Photoshop User Magazine. Has anybody seen that? It's also a website. Photoshop User is a really good website with a lot of tutorials and a lot of content. Scott Kelby is like, he's the Bill Gates of digital photography at this point. He's got a whole bunch of things going on, a whole bunch of different magazines, a whole bunch of book publications. He does talks, he does lectures. He just did a lecture actually in San Francisco over the break, I think. He does demos, more like a software guy than, or more like a software demo than it is a photo demo. They're kind of on that high-tech kind of track. But a really interesting approach to Photoshop that I actually teach in the similar way, my approach to Photoshop, Adobe Photoshop, is similar in that it kind of cuts through all of the, there's a lot of features in Photoshop that you don't need for photography. There's a lot of stuff for compositing, there's a lot of stuff for graphic design projects, a lot of stuff for animation, a lot of stuff for illustration. He cuts through all of that and just gets to the stuff that has to do with photography and processing images. So this I would highly recommend, except for there's another one I want to show you, which is Peachpit Press, which is the total Photoshop reference, which would give you access to all of the features and functions of Photoshop in a kind of technical reference form. This one cuts through all of that and is really good in terms of building workflow. And workflow within photography is that terminology I want you to understand is kind of how you process all the way from camera to print or all the way from camera to the web. That whole flow of how you deal with an image is considered your workflow, right? This is really a book about workflow. It's how you structure your environment, your whole software kind of process. And it's really good for that. The other book that I'll bring on Tuesday is a really good comprehensive reference book for Photoshop. Whether you were going to do graphic design or be a photographer or whatever, but this would be a good one to do. And then, like I said, Scott Kelby's making so much money off of people, it's kind of sick. This is something I would not recommend that you buy, which is he promotes all kinds of other publications. This is like the tips book, and it comes in a set. Scott Kelby's, well, so like, not, don't buy everything from Scott Kelby, just because he does that thing really great. He also sells a lot of crap to just get your money. So this, I think, now is like a 4 or 5 book volume. I got it. Again, I'll try to get anything free that you might find or you might want to look at that comes out. I don't think I would have paid for this. I hope I didn't pay anything for this. Anyway, it's just like a book of tips, right? But he puts his name on it, and because that's so great, his workflow, and it's very practical, you think, oh, this is going to be great. And then you go out and buy this, and it costs like, this is $70, right? And I want to send this around so that you see it. It's got good tips in it, no doubt, that you can use some of this stuff. Most of it's just silly, though. And it's compiled in a way that is completely makes no sense whatsoever. So it's kind of a fetish object because you look at it and you're like, wow, that's going to like change my whole life, right? And then you buy it and it's like so random. And like I can't apply those tips to anything that I'm actually doing. So I want you to know what to avoid. So I send them around. You can look through them. You know, some of them, they're fine. You can put them to work for sure. You just don't want to spend, you don't want to spend $70. To find out how to make your flash balance. Okay. Then the other book I have for you is one of the greatest photographers of all time, who we're going to talk about, and I'll just talk about him today, just so you have it, is Edward Muybridge. Has anybody ever heard of Edward Muybridge? Yes, tell me about it. Local boy, who, in an illustrious past, well, he was working in San Francisco. He didn't do photography until he got to San Francisco. Started out as a landscape photographer and then became a motion photographer or locomotion photographer. Concentrated on animal and human locomotion, so he documented the movement of bodies, right? That was his specialty. And in fact, he was the most technologically advanced photographer of his time. This is a guy that you might have heard a story or two about, especially in Northern California, floats around, the mythology of Edward Muybridge floats around a lot because he was a guy who got away with murdering his wife's lover based on the insanity plea. So he's one of those. So every now and then his name pops up because of that. He was the guy who Leland Stanford hired to prove that the horse's hooves leave the ground whenever it sprints. And there was a big gamble between Leland Stanford and another one of those railroad magnates. It was something like for a dollar. No, actually, I messed that up. I think it was $10,000, actually, which at the time would have been like a $100,000 bet between him and this other guy. And Mybridge was the one that proved it, that in fact the horse did leave the ground whenever it sprinted. All four hooves leave the ground. And he did that, and in the process of doing that, he innovated in ways that changed everything. Basically, everything having to do with imaging, photography, motion pictures, movies, multimedia, digital, everything. And he doesn't really actually get enough credit, I don't think, considering what his innovations led to. It's surprising to me that more people don't talk about him. Because literally everything that he invented led to everything that exists in terms of digital media now. And he was one of the earliest innovators in terms of hardware. He was a genius across the board in terms of what he was able to develop. He developed his own film. He upped the ISO, or the speed, the sensitivity of film, in order to capture the horses in motion, which nothing in motion had ever been stopped prior to Edward Mybridge. So he was the reason we have such fast film. He developed the shutter, the electronic trip shutter, which increased the speed of the shutter so that he could close, open and close the shutter that fast. He developed the actual hardware for all of those based on, or working from, basically a camera obscura, working from basically a box camera. So he developed the film, the hardware, he developed the projection method for showing all of the image sequences that he developed of animals and eventually humans, animals, all sorts of things. He developed the projection method, which inspired, was it Graham Bell? Alexander Graham Bell, who invented the movie camera? I always have to look that one up. Anyway, whenever he came back from Europe, after showing all of the scientific studies that he'd done with the animals, specifically with the horses, he also stopped in New York and then went through Pennsylvania. And the process of showing the work there is what led to motion picture, basically. The whole Kodak, that whole phenomenon came from the zoetropes that he modified and the lantern slides that he used in order to show these image sequences and animate them, triggered this whole idea of doing a movie camera. So it's pretty impressive what he was able to accomplish. And we could attribute the whole thing to a stagecoach accident, because basically after he got into a stagecoach accident, it damaged his brain in a way that focused his mind in an incredible means, and he just started, like, he just became crazy. I mean, he was just crazy smart. They just said, you know, he was in San Francisco, he was smart to begin with, he was making tons of money off landscapes, he was one of the first photographers to go into Yosemite and shoot sublime landscapes in Yosemite, and he was selling those and was quite famous. But he then took a trip to Europe, and in the process had this accident, and came back like a genius. Like, just went crazy and just started making and innovating in ways that are just incredible. So, somebody I really want you to look up. I give you a bunch of links to him. I have the complete set of Mybridge's works. I probably should have brought you the horses to begin with, but I brought you the humans. So, but this one's kind of big. So instead of passing it around, I'll put it back on the big desk on the back. At some point, go back and check it out. We'll take a little bit of a break and even look at it. And that's Mybridge on the front. He was not only, he was also modest. He was willing to walk naked across his own work, which is pretty impressive also. So you can see him on the front. But check them out. They're poetic little vignettes of life that are pretty amazing. And I'll put them over here and you can look. And you can see there's a lot of that material online too for you to see. Edison, that was it. Yeah, I always forget if it's Bell or Edison. And he met with him on the way back. And Edison was really interested in seeing the images that he had made. And so he showed him the images. And while he was in Europe, he had developed this way of taking, I think it was actually a praxinoscope, which is, the zoetrope runs, it's a base, it runs this way, and a praxinoscope runs this way. And it has slits in it, and it was a 19th century animation device. He took that and put that wheel in front of a lantern slide and put the images on it and then projected. So basically he built, you know, it was a just a wheel. It was a finite number of images, but you could watch them in sequence. Pretty cool. Smart guy. Really smart guy. So he doesn't actually show up. I guess I wasn't supposed to talk about him until next week. Where's that horse from? Oh, 2 weeks. Oh, well, we'll have so many things between now and then it won't matter. But there you can get to a link of his. And there's the horse. That's not Sally Gardner. The very first horse that they photographed, that's a much later horse. I think that was one of Stanford's horses also. He had quite a collection of horses. There you can see the hooves leaving the ground. The first one actually that they did, the first exposure, he didn't have the film at a high enough ISO yet. And I mean, the sensitivity of film probably at that time was around 3 to 5, which we'll talk about ISO a little bit later. That's one of the first things you have to get a grasp of is film speed or sensor sensitivity. The ISO at that time, you would have an average exposure probably of 20 minutes. Like a short exposure would have been maybe 20 minutes of a portrait in full sun, midday. That's why they had posing chairs for even for portraits that had metal loops that would hold people's heads steady, so you'd be there in the middle loop. That's why everybody looks kind of sick when they're sitting there, probably. So the first thing he had to take on was to develop the sensitivity, bring the sensitivity up of the actual film substrate as he was working with it. And then he had to work on the shutter in order to get the shutter to go off fast enough to capture frames like that. But the first horse that they photographed, the exposure was so light that they had to go in and paint the hooves in. You could actually see where the hoof was, like, you know, it picked up edges where the sun hit or whatever. And so they could paint exactly where it was, but they took the prints to the newspaper to substantiate it. So the newspaper is kind of like validation, right? You take it to the newspaper. If the newspaper believes it's newsworthy and they publish it, then it becomes true. At that time, newspapers, everybody actually believed them. And whenever they took the prints to the newspaper, they didn't believe it because the images had been manipulated, which is curious, which will be a theme throughout the semester. So they had to go back and reshoot it. So they went back and re-photographed, got the sensitivity up or got the light values up again. They got better exposures of the second horse, and then the newspaper was willing to accept it, and so then they proved it.
It's amazing that still is part of that horse is the tail.
Yeah, that's a good point. It just kind of sticks there, doesn't it?
They cut it so straight.
Yeah. You can see the frame count here in the side for the camera. Okay, so let's see, what else are we talking about? We need to set up home directories, so we've got a place to store images, because Tuesday, whenever we come back, we want to upload some images, and then we want to all figure out what we're going to photograph, what we're interested in photographing, and why we're in here. So that's, we have a technical feat to achieve by setting that up. I want to just run through your assignments in case you didn't get through them all. Anybody having trouble finding their cameraman? Everybody able to do that? You're all thrilled that I'm making you read that?
The user's manual?
Yeah, the user's manual. The big one, not the quick setup guide either. Cover to cover. Great reading over the weekend. It's going to rain. Cuddle up with your manual. It's also a good thing since it's going to be raining, and this is probably the most embarrassing part because your family members are going to think you're really odd and you've taken this class. Maybe it wasn't such a good idea. I'd like you to play with the camera a lot over the weekend, too. While you've got the manual there and you're working your way through it, it's good to kind of sit and play with it. Get used to holding it. Get used to not necessarily looking at it the whole time you're doing stuff, but knowing what you're doing. You know, looking through it, adjusting things, looking at what those dials are actually saying now instead of just punching buttons till something happens. So start to identify, like, you know, there's a little button that says ISO, ISO. And you probably looked at it 5 or 6 times and you might have dialed it up, But you kind of want to start to associate things. And the more time you spend with the camera, just holding it, manipulating, all of that gets you more familiar with the balance and the weight of it. All of that seems a little compulsive, maybe a little weird, fetishistic, but it also pays off whenever you go out and actually shoot, because it's a technical device that you're holding, and it's between you and what you're actually wanting to make an image of, right? So the more it can start to disappear between you and that thing, the more that you can become integrated with it, to become one with your camera, the better your work's going to be. Which seems a little silly, but it really doesn't in the long run. Just getting used to holding it and getting used to the balance of the camera, then you're not thinking about that when you're trying to shoot. You're not jiggling around and doing all of that. Playing around with the barrel of the lens, getting used to zooming in and out, understanding what that zoom is and what the distance is, looking through the viewfinder and doing all of that stuff is really good. So while you're working through the manual and playing around with the menus, that's a good thing to do, is kind of get used to it. Figure out your method. Are you going to put it around your neck? Are you going to wrap the strap around your arm? What are you going to do with it? How are you going to hold it? You know, and manipulate. Turn sideways. Turn landscape, go to portrait. Landscape, go to portrait. What happens if I go this direction? What if I turn it upside down? Can I still hold it? What if I need to get it above my head? Can I still see it? That back LCD, can you manipulate that so you can see things and you can get it higher than you're used to shooting? Can you put it down and still see through? Manipulation, doing all of that stuff just makes you more agile whenever you're shooting. And the more you work with that, the more you can stay in touch with what you're looking at, what you're photographing, what you're trying to pay attention to, and you're not paying attention to that device all the time, right? So we want to do that, and let them make fun of you. They'll only make fun of you until your prints sell for $7,000 to $15,000, maybe $25,000, and then they'll stop making fun of you altogether, right? Okay, so everybody's got a manual. If you have the print manual, you might also, if you've got some time, go on to the manufacturer's site and grab the PDF of it, which is good just to archive in case something happens with the manual and you lose it. And you can also shuffle through it in a different way whenever it's online. I would stick it on a flash drive. If you've got a flash drive, you're going to bring it back and forth just in case you forget the manual or something like that. Stick it on a flash, and then you can bring it in too. Journals, remember, if you've got a journal, starting to keep notes, even if, you know, maybe just the notes that you're making in here, keeping that in a journal so you've got that with you. If it's something that you can keep in your camera bag or in your back pocket, that's really good as a journal. Remember, you also, if you miss an assignment or there's one you can't stand to do, like a bracketing assignment potentially, then you could turn in the journal to get credit for that. Textbook we already talked about. Anybody have trouble finding highest resolution? Anybody find resolution anywhere mentioned in their manual at all?
Quality.
And quality could be anything. Quality is size, quality is compression.
So mine was like kind of combined. It was like, yeah, there were two high resolution. One was high resolution with low compression, and one was high resolution.
Right, or high quality, right?
Yeah.
And then there's this lovely drawing. I think Canon's the one that does this. This is low compression.
Yeah.
No, this is high compression. Sorry, this is low compression. This is higher quality. This is low quality.
It's the other way around.
Because this is chunky, and this is smooth.
Let me check.
So I digital, when they show it digital art, if you can see the pixels, right, then it's not reproducing the arc very well, which means the pixels aren't smaller.
Right. I have the L and the chunky one.
Right,
for low compression.
So then if I add a few more pixels, the arc starts to get a little smoother. So the more pixels I've got, maybe the higher the resolution. So that's the idea, is this is a qualitative thing. It's how smooth is that arc. And it also refers to audio. So in audio, they talk about is the wave. You know, and a digital wave is kind of chunky, and a smooth wave.
So that's high, that's low?
Yeah, so the stair step one, that's low resolution.
Oh.
And the smooth one, that's the high. Because it's a nice smooth.
I misheard it, yeah.
Smooth art.
Which one would you want if you had the kid?
It's the smooth one, right?
The smooth one. The smooth one is lower compression. So compression removes, compression you'll read about lossy and lossless. And lossy and lossless, like everything in photography, is oppositional. It has to do with defining a different type of compression. And then lossy and lossless don't make any sense. And you'd have to read it 5 or 6 times in order for it to make sense, and then you give it a week and it stops making sense. So don't think of it that way. What you can think about with regard to compression is meant to remove redundancy within an image, regardless of what they tell you. If I take a picture of the sky, right? The sky's blue, or it's not today, but let's say the sky's blue. If the sky is consistently blue within a certain range of the sky, then why would I bother to store the entire sky? I can just store a sample of the blue, and I can, you know, kind of map like a draw by numbers. I can map this area is this color of blue, and this area is this color of blue, and this area is this color of blue, and then I only have to store 3 values for all of that blue sky, so then my file size drops down to just 3 numbers. That's compression, right? In that process, though, I'm reducing the quality, because then the computer has to rebuild that drawing based on those 3 values, right? And if those 3 values don't really cover the subtlety of the blue of the sky, then we end up with this kind of stair step look to the sky where you've got banding. I'm sure you've seen this. You've seen low resolution images of the sky where it's banded. There's different blues and they kind of move through it like that. That's low resolution, right? Because it tried to repaint that image with just a few values. So if I store more, I have a cleaner image. So lower compression, again, oppositional logic, lower compression means more data, bloated file size, because I'm storing more of it to try to recreate the best quality image I can get. But if I have stronger compression, I'm throwing away information that I paid to capture, right? It's a capture device. What you paid for was you want to capture as much of the light value as you can capture. And you paid, and I told you this, I think, already, you pay in photography, you get exactly what you pay for, and you certainly won't get any more. You might get less if they can get away with it, but they're going to make you pay for everything. So file size, as your file size goes up, as the camera gets more sophisticated with regard to or produces better quality images, you pay more, right? And it's basically broken down by the size of the print that you can make. So a point-and-shoot camera does a 4x6, like you used to get when you go to the drugstore, right? A lower resolution, cheaper point-and-shoot. And then as you get into the DSLR, they start to get bigger. So you got an 8.5x11 with the standard kind of average DSLR. And then the big ones, the big commercial ones, 50s, the 64-bit that we were talking about. Those are, you know, 20x24 images right out of the camera that I can print. So it's basically equivalent to the file size and or equivalent to the print size at good quality. So what I'm trying to get you to do by increasing and making sure that you've got it to the highest resolution and the lowest compression is that you're getting what you paid for, right? You paid for 6, 10, 12, 24 megapixels. Make sure you're getting all the megapixels. So the assignment next week then is we'll go into Photoshop and you can actually count all of your pixels, which everyone has to do, so you have to go to account. Okay? Can you imagine counting 24 megapixels? How many pixels would that be?
24 million.
That would be a lot. It would take a while. That won't be enough. Okay, how about the flash? Anybody have trouble with their flash? Used to we had trouble with the flash, like I told you. Point shoots used to come, and you'd have to turn the flash off after every shot. So you'd have to choose, do I want to flash or not want to flash? You'd say no, and take a picture, and then it turns the flash back on. Now you just put it in P mode. Put it in P mode. I want everybody to shoot in P mode anyway. So P is our mode. If you're advanced, if you are already, the only way you'd be out of P is if you were shooting in manual. If you're already a manual shooter, you already adopted that as your method, then just do, you can stay with manual. But P is a good mode. P is our auto. P is a controllable auto is what it is. P is also a customizable auto. So auto is no one I know, so I use P because I can program him to be exactly what I want him to be, right? If you put it on the green one, there's always that little green mode. That green mode is truly auto, and that's an engineer someplace in the universe who has never taken a picture in his entire life. He has no idea what he's doing, and he configured the camera all wrong. And he turned on the flash. So P mode turns off the flash. It gives it to you, then you hit the little button beside it, and it'll pop up anytime you want it. And like I said, I want you to turn the flash off until further notice. With one disclaimer, if something's going on in your life and your wife, significant other, sister, mother, whatever, that's kind of weird, but if they ask you to photograph the birth of the child or something like that, their wedding, something else, you can turn on the flash. Because I don't want you to miss something significant that maybe you needed the flash for. I'll just tell you, the flash won't generate the best image. It's usually kind of awful, flat lighting that isn't attractive. But then it's your sister, so you know. No, I don't mean that. But if something's going on that you don't feel like you're capable yet of photographing and getting it just right and you might miss it, then you can turn on the flash. The flash is basically just that. It's canned light that covers you in an emergency. And they designed it in such a way as it's in the worst possible location. It provides the worst possible type of light. It's good for an emergency because it just gives you exactly the light you need to get an exposure of whatever it is you're photographing, just with no real sense of beauty to it. So if something comes up, then turn your flash on. But for me, don't turn the flash on. And I don't mind if the images are worse because of it. Because anything that's wrong with the image, I want you to understand, and the way you understand that is by learning how to overcome that limitation. So shoot everything without the flash, which is fine and seems okay until we get to the first assignment and you're out there shooting in low light and you're wanting to turn on that flash, but you have to resist it. And I know when the flash goes off, always, by the way, you can't fool me. There's a thing called metadata that saves us a lot of trouble and also can get you in a lot of trouble, is that it records everything that's going on with the camera whenever you're shooting to every single image that you make. So all I have to do is pull up the bridge and I can look and I can see, did the flash go off? And it'll tell me the flash went off. So you can't fool me, I don't. Okay. Plus it's pretty obvious because it really looks bad, unless you know what you're doing. So flash, just put it on P mode. We stay on P mode and we'll talk through that. First three or four, we can actually stay in P mode to shoot. So it's not hard. Backing up all the images off of your card and not using a card as storage, okay? You don't have to format it this week, I suppose. You hopefully won't fragment over the weekend. But remember, those cards are horrible for storage. They're meant as temporary. So I want you to back everything up, being careful that if you've used it as storage and you take all of those images and dump them onto your home computer, you want to make sure you have an adequate amount of space on your home computer to put all those images onto so that it backs up and doesn't then corrupt your entire operating system and take your computer down. And the reason that I say that is that this has happened. I have had a student in the past, two actually, who took home the card or the camera and they took all the images and they put it on there. They completely filled up their hard drive because they weren't paying attention to what was going on with their home system, and it corrupted the operating system and they lost the entire computer plus all the images. And then we formatted the card, which meant that they formatted the card and lost all the images from the card. There was only one student who did all of that. The other one didn't format the card, so they still had images, but they lost their home computer. So you want to watch out for that. You remember I said it was optional whether or not you had storage, but for my money, if I were you taking the class, I'd probably go out and get a hard drive, removable hard drive or a portable hard drive that I can plug in, and I would put all the images onto that and start to work off that for images and not put them onto the same hard drive that you have the operating system.
Would you have two copies apart, another copy apart from that hard drive, external hard drive?
Well, someone like Scott Kelby in that book, he talks about, well, I don't think he does it anymore, but he used to plug the camera in, he would burn a DVD of the card in the camera with it just plugged in. And then he would copy to his external hard drive the images that he would then work on before he formatted the card. So he had two copies. He had an archival that was on DVD that he put away, and he had a copy on a removable hard drive that he had plugged into the computer that he worked from whenever he worked on. That's a lot of effort for me. I mean, I do backups where I have external hard drives that I copy all my images to and I archive, and then I'll often do duplicate images that I work with on the computer that I'm actually working on, and then I archive that hard drive and I put the archive away on another hard drive periodically over the course of the year, but I don't burn the card to a DVD and then do another external hard drive and then work off that. If you're working for money, that's client imagery, and you're being paid to go and shoot that, and if staging that again would be an exorbitant cost that you would have to eat because it's client stuff, then you probably want to back all that stuff up, duplicates, so that you don't lose any of it, right? That's how you keep track of your money, I suppose. So it depends, but for the class, I mean, if you're just backing up, I just don't want anybody to lose their computer or lose their operating system in the process, so I would probably get an external hard drive. I just saw one yesterday too. I went someplace. I went to Office Depot, and at the end of one of the rows in Office Depot, they had 1 terabyte removable hard drives on sale, and now I forgot what the price was. But as I walked by, I thought of you guys, and I thought, I should tell them about that. They're 1 terabyte, and 1 terabyte, you'd probably fill it up this semester, but it would give you storage. You'd be good probably for the semester with 1 terabyte. Depends on how much you shoot. So they're really cheap. And like I was saying, don't use a flash drive though. Flash drive is different than a removable drive. Even though the media ultimately, whenever you break down everything, is probably the same. It's encased and it's powered and it's more reliable. Okay, then I'll want you to format. So I want you to copy all those images. Make sure you got a good backup of them. You can get the images in here Tuesday or whatever so that you can show them. I want you to have 5 to 10 images. Either you photograph what you are inspired by or you bring them in on, bring in images from the past that you thought were really good. You can keep the images on the card if you have images on your camera now that you want to use for that presentation or what you want to give me, then I don't want you to lose that. You could actually copy them today because I'm going to have a set up home directories so that you'll have space to copy to while you're here. You could copy to those. But definitely by Tuesday. Tuesday I want everyone to have formatted or go through the process of formatting together so that Thursday, whenever you take on, you know, the shooting assignment, Tuesday, Thursday, you're on a clean card. Because starting clean will save you from having to redo any assignment, and it's just the better way to kick off your workflow so you've got a good process. And you want to make that part of the process. Whenever you go out and shoot and you put a significant number of images onto the card, you want to back it up and you want to start over, right? That's the cleanest write that you're going to get. That's the best images you're going to get. And again, you paid for this great image, this resolution, this sensor download, right? Make sure the storage is ready for it and that it's going to be clean. Because you can get corruption in an image and it eats through the image. It kind of does this banding thing that happens where you get these like weird noise stripes that come through an image and it ruins your images. And you can't do it again. And you know, we're shooting things that are temporal. They're here and then they're gone. So if you get something really good on a given day with this weather, with whatever, you know, whatever time of day and the time of season and everything, you can't replicate it. You might be able to go back to that site and shoot again, but you may not get the same conditions that you had the first time. And that's a huge drag whenever you lose it. So you just got to be prepared. And if we establish good habits as we start, they carry throughout. So it's good. So by Tuesday, we want to format.
Does a brand new card need to be formatted?
I always format the card as soon as I buy one, because they format it, right? The manufacturer formats it. But the relationship between the camera and the card is the most important relationship, right? I can format the card with a computer. I can format the card with something else. I don't know what. But I want to establish the relationship between the camera and that card. So every manufacturer's CPU, or the CPU in your camera, does things differently than any other camera, and certainly any other computer. And so if you use that camera to format that card, you know that camera talks to that card the way it's supposed to. They're in sync. Okay, and then just a reminder, 5 to 10 for next Tuesday, we'll start, I'll run through them. You won't have to drive. I'll do the driving, but we'll just kind of talk through what is your particular interest in photography. And then, like I said, that's always a really good conversation. Everybody gets to know who's shooting similar things, and you can buddy up and like find locations that are good, or find, even share models. I've had lots of instances where people, like, you know, they want to work with a certain type of person, or they want to get a model. They can do that together, and you can set it up. It's kind of cool. Find locations to do things like I said, like graffiti is a good one, something like that. Chapters in the book, again, you know, those run for 2 weeks, so you've got plenty of time, and those chapters go down easy. Now, there is no chapter in that book that's hard to get through. Any of them you can do in an hour. You've got some sites to look at here. I don't know if I ran through all of those. I think we looked at local galleries. Masters of Photography. If you're new to photography and you've never heard of any of the, you know, fine art photographers like Cartier-Bresson is a new name, or Edward Weston, or Ansel Adams. Anybody heard of Ansel Adams? Ansel, a lot of people have heard of Ansel Adams by now. I mean, a Northern California guy, so that one. But Masters of Photography, it's a good one to check when you're in here. They used to have all kinds of pop-ups that came in and drove me insane. They just kind of list out the biggies. And you can get a few examples of their work. Like, here's my bridge. And they've got examples of stuff that he had done. I don't like the interface anymore. This guy used to have a really interesting, that's one we've seen. So this is just masters, just to kind of feel like you've got a few reference points for where photography starts and where we are. This is a good one. These are the big names. Kind of the big names in the history of it. And some of them are contemporary, like Cindy Sherman. This is someone, anybody see the Cindy Sherman show in the city? She's the one who dresses up in all kinds of outfits, body outfits and stuff like that, the most recent stuff. But the early work that she did where she kind of restaged film scenes, classic film scenes that a lot of people would have known, cultural kind of icons. She dressed up as that person in a lot of cases. I'm not a huge fan of her, but I'm starting to understand, maybe. Stephen Shore, color photographer, one of the first color photographers following the footsteps of Cartier-Bresson. So a lot of street photography, but in color. Pretty interesting stuff. You can just look through them just to get a sense of what is this, you know, maybe you've only seen some coffee table books here and there of stuff that was photography, and then you started taking it and you just liked what you were doing, but you hadn't looked into it. So these are just kind of historical figures. All of these, more than likely, we'll talk about it at one time or another. A lot of these are broken. I'll talk to you about most of those over the course of the semester, so you'll also get some of these. This is something to remember, maybe to come back to. And now he won't let me out. Loma Graphic Society. Loma Graphic Society, anybody heard of a Lomo camera? So Lomo is this Russian camera manufacturer that this group of people encouraged to remanufacture 35 millimeter cameras, and they started making them new. And they got a whole bunch of people paying attention to it, and then kind of this whole scene emerged out of this one Russian tank of a camera that was like a metal camera that just weighed so much. It was incredible that they pulled this off. But you'll see their products all around. They're the ones that redid the plastic camera, the Diana, and brought it back. They've redone all of these film-based cameras and generated a whole community around film that had kind of died out. So it's kind of shocking. They also do magazines, or they do print publications that show up every now and then. And they do a really cool website that's worth checking out. It's just kind of a crazy community around photography that has emerged in the last couple of years that I'd like you to know about. ArtSpace, what's ArtSpace? ArtSpace is just one of those online contemporary art sites. You can go on there and kind of see what people are selling. There's a lot of contemporary photography on there. Some of it's a little racy, like Araki is basically a pornographer. So watch out for some of it. I mean, his work is really good, but it's a little sketchy. Art.com is another online site. There's a lot of photography being sold online. DeviantArt, there's a lot of photographers too, if you've never been on DeviantArt. I don't link to that one. But it's kind of cool just to look and see what people are doing, like what could you be doing. I mean, they're having a special sale. A snowy owl for $26. Camera reviews down here. I didn't mention these last time, so I want to get that real quick. DP Review is my preferred site for technical reviews. That's lenses, new camera bodies, all of that. That's a great site. You can count on them. And they give you a good side-by-side comparison of all the cameras. So I can browse cameras. I can choose two Canons and put them side-by-side and look at the features of each, and then look at the prices of each. Any new lens that comes out for any camera, you can put that up and you can look at it, you can compare it to the previous series of lens, that kind of stuff. This is just a really good kind of standard site. So like Canons, if I'm thinking about upgrading, I could do the 60 and the 70, and I say compare, and I look at the two of them, and I can see what the differences are in terms of all the specs, and it's just got nice features for that. DP Review is a really good one, and they come out with everything new. So anything new that shows up, it'll show up on DP Review. So that's why I linked those in your first. And then KEH, which is the second link that you got on the first set of resources. KEH buys and sells used camera equipment. And it's one of the biggest sites to buy and sell used camera equipment. So if you've got, if you're just getting into this, a lot of people come in and, you know, like their grandfather gave them their 35 millimeter kit with all the lenses, and they've got that floating around, but then they got a digital camera and they don't know what to do with it. You could sell the 35 millimeters, unless there's sentimental value, you can sell that on KEH and maybe buy a lens for your digital. Or if you don't like the digital that you got and you want to upgrade it because you've been working with it for a little while, KEH will give you pricing and will also sell, they'll sell stuff and give you values. So it's a good site to go onto and also just see what's my camera worth now, right? Or what's this camera worth that, you know, my parents had in their closet? Can I make any money off of it?
What was the previous website with the lion and the snowy owl? ArtSpace.com?
Art.com?
Okay.
And that one, actually, you'll see that in the East Bay whenever you're driving into the freeway, right at Ashby. It's up on the thing over there. Art.com.
Really cool. There's like a person in the mushroom, and then there's like
another.
There's a really cool art on
the
wall, on 580.
That might be on around. That might be after you get. This one's right on 80. Right as you know, there's San Francisco. There's the park with the sculpture garden, and then there's that weird little jetty of office buildings that stick up in a Chevy's. It's some weird little, it's a right across from where IKEA is. It's a weird, and it says art.com on top of it. And it's just an online market for artwork, which is good to look at. I'll show you some other sites that are like the blue chip end of the art market. So art.com and all of that, that's kind of like, you know, regular people, like you and I selling prints and stuff. And then I'll show you the other ones, like Sotheby's and Christie's, which are like the blue chip, you know, art gallery people selling their prints. And then we're talking about, you know, starts at 3 and goes to $150,000 for whatever they throw up on Canvas. Okay, so that's pretty much everything from this week. Then what I want to do is I was going to show you a little bit of my work and tell you what I kind of, where I come from. And then I also want us to set up our home directories. But I've now talked to you for quite a long time, so I'm going to give you a break. So you have 10 minutes to clear your head of my voice and breathe some air.